Once you uncork all the things that are buried inside of you that you're not letting out, you'll feel better. There's a freedom in getting it out on the page. Just do it safely.
Hi, I'm Ebony, and I believe that stories change lives, and everyone has a story worth telling. Sometimes, unfortunately, we let our self-doubt get in the way of us writing our stories and sharing our stories. So that's why I created Motivation to Write as a source of motivation and inspiration to help writers like you and me share our stories with the world. So I talk to the experts ranging from entrepreneurs to marketers to authors to therapists to psychologists who share their knowledge and their advice to help writers like you and me step into our full potential.
Laura Davis is a writing teacher and a seven-time best-selling author who believes in the healing power of writing. Her first book, The Courage to Heal, launched the Incest Survivor Empowerment Movement. Laura continues to publish personal narratives exploring family, love, and relationships. Her most recent book and first memoir, The Burning Light of Two Stars, A Mother-Daughter Story, tells the story of her tumultuous relationship with her mother.
I'm here with Laura Davis, author of The Courage to Heal, among many other books. Laura, how are you?
I'm good. I'm really excited to be talking to you today.
Yes, I'm excited to have you because you know a lot about how we can use writing as a tool for healing, and I'm all about that. I am a great proponent of journaling as a tool for healing, and I know that you have a very interesting story as to even how that started for you, using writing as a tool for healing. So I was wondering if you can maybe first tell us a little bit about when you personally first learned that writing could help heal you.
I mean, I think it was probably when I could first hold one of those big fat blue pencils in elementary school. I mean, probably at the whatever age I was when I got fluid enough to be able to write fluently. You know, I've really used writing my whole life as a tool to explore, to seek the truth, to know what I was feeling, to understand myself, to find answers, to break silence, to confront, to grieve, and to make my most important life decisions. Mm-hmm. And I often will sort things out on the page and admit things on the page before I'm ready to tell anyone, not my spouse of 30 years or my best friends or, you know, the people closest to me. There's something about the page for me that is a sacred place. Mm-hmm. And it's also a really safe place. It's a place I feel comfortable, even though sometimes it's very painful to write. Mm-hmm. So I've always used writing that way. And then I've also used it always in the public sphere too. So, you know, to provoke, to inform, to agitate, to educate, to tell stories, to entertain, and to inspire people. So, you know, on my website, I have this little tagline. It says, healing words that change lives. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that capsulizes everything I've done in terms of the, you know, the seven books I've written and the writing teaching I've done for the last 25 years. It's really about how to use words in a way that empowers people and promotes healing.
So when you were as a kid with your fat pencil writing, did you start off like in a diary? Because I know for myself, I think when I first learned that writing is something powerful, not even necessarily as a tool for healing, but something really powerful, was in probably fifth grade when our teacher bought us all a diary book and we wrote in our diaries every day in class for like 10 minutes. And I still have that diary from fifth grade. And that's when I realized that there's something really powerful happening, because I remember writing in that book and feeling as though I was just releasing all of the stress that a 10-year-old can experience at, you know, in that moment in her life. But how was that in a diary, or what were you, letters?
The first diary I had was like a little tiny square book that had like a thick cover, and then it had like a little clasp that went around, and it locked. It had a teeny tiny little key. And I think that was probably my favorite part, was the teeny tiny little key and opening it. And I, you know, that first diary probably just had things like, you know, I had ice cream today.
Right, yeah.
I don't think I was using it for any kind of introspective mm-hmm. purpose. But, you know, I think I did write in journals. It's interesting because I've gone back when I was working on my memoir, I felt like I had to go back and revisit my old journals. Mm-hmm. And I have not been a consistent journaler, but I wrote a lot of journals in my teens, 20s, and into my early 30s. And then I sort of stopped. But I found that I only wrote when I was depressed. Mm-hmm. So it was actually quite painful to go back and have to revisit, particularly like the years in my early 20s where I was very lost. You know, I was doing a lot of drugs and I didn't know what I was doing. And I was putting myself in humiliating relationships. I mean, just like the time in life you don't really want to go back to.
Right.
So it was hard to go back and read that without, I wanted to have empathy for the young woman I had been, you know, mm-hmm. because I'd had a lot of trauma mm-hmm. in my life. And there's reasons I was acting that way, you know, because I had unresolved trauma that I hadn't healed. But it was hard to do. But I could see that I was, at that point, I was writing more to like vent than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
When I was 27 years old was when I first remembered that I had been sexually abused by my grandfather. And mm-hmm. the very first thing I did was I joined a writing group. With a woman named Sandra Butler, who wrote the book, The Conspiracy of Silence, one of the really early incest books.
Yeah.
It was in San Francisco, and I don't know if there were like a dozen of us or eight of us, we went every week, and she gave us just amazing writing prompts. And it just opened this floodgate of writing. And it's like, I had to tell the story. I had to have the story witnessed by other people. And that one experience in that group really laid the groundwork for so much of how I've used writing and how I've taught writing in the decades since then. Because I think it's, you know, I don't think it's enough to just write it down.
Right.
Because it just, it like festers in your notebook. There's something very powerful about reading those words out loud. And if you could read it to a witness who is safe,
yeah.
who's not going to be there to critique it or judge it or evaluate it, or not someone close to you who's going to say, I don't remember that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember it that way, or right. you can't say that about mom, or right. you know, yeah. whatever, you know. But like in a writing group, you have this built-in container where there's confidentiality, and people are trained, at least in my classes, people are trained not to respond to raw first draft writing. So there's really that feeling of you're being witnessed, and your life experience, whatever you've written about, is being accepted and honored. And there's something about the voice when you say the words out loud, it has a very different impact than just writing them down.
Mm-hmm.
And we often don't know what it is we've written. And when you speak it out loud, the impact, the emotional impact sometimes really hits you. So I often say to people, you know, the first time they come to a class, I say, you know, don't be surprised if when you read your work out loud, you cry.
Yeah.
It might be unexpected mm-hmm. because suddenly you're getting the impact. You're feeling it in your body, in your cells. What it is you've said. And then to be listened to in that way with a non-judgmental, compassionate listener, we just don't get that very much in life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of our conversations, the other person is planning what they're going to say next, and they're talking and we're planning what we're going to say next, and we're interrupting each other. And there's nothing wrong with that kind of conversation, but it's very different than sacred witnessing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to, when you mentioned the writing group, I was going to ask how much more different is it to participate in a writing group versus to write privately in your, you know, in your journal or diary or whatever. It's the sharing part that is so powerful and so scary for a lot of people. And I feel like this is why a lot of people, they write these fabulous stories, whether fiction or not, nonfiction, and they don't want to share because they are scared of public reception. Like, what are people going to say about me? Or I can't write, or they're going to laugh at me, or whatever. But there is something very powerful about being heard.
I mean, I have so many people come to class and they love to write at some point in their life, and they haven't written in 15 years, 20 years, 30 years, because they were in a college class and their work got ripped up, you know, or someone, it could make one person making one comment.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is not about writing, but I love to sing. And my father was a musician and a music teacher. So there was a lot of singing and music in my house. And I went, when I was in elementary school, there was like the chorus.
Yeah.
Just like elementary school, you know, the music teacher would come in and we'd sing. There was still funding for things like that back then. Yeah. And the teacher told me, just mouth the words. Because probably I was like 8 years old and super enthusiastic and maybe I was singing too loud. And I didn't sing for decades after that.
Yeah.
You know, just that one comment. And so many people are shut down around their writing. They've been shamed, or maybe someone read their journal and betrayed their confidence, mm-hmm. you know, or someone criticized them, or so it takes a lot. And that's why I think beginning in a setting where there's no critique is very, very important. And we're so product oriented in our society that mm-hmm. when you say you're a writer, the next question is, well, what have you written?
Right.
You know, or are you writing a book? It's like, there's so many other ways to use writing before you get to, are you writing a book? Mm-hmm. And I really encourage people to just write for the pleasure of it, for the, to explore their voice mm-hmm. As a tool for healing or for transformation. And let the question of what you're going to do with that writing, put it aside for a long time mm-hmm. and just get deep into your voice, because that's what, you know, it's easier to learn the craft, but to access the deepest, truest, rawest material, that's hard. There are a lot of people who are very proficient with the craft of writing, but they can't access the really deep transformational material. And so, you know, that's what I recommend.
How do you access that, Laura, the deep transformational material?
Well, I think the first thing is to have a really safe container for doing the writing, whether you're doing it at home on your own mm-hmm. Or you're doing it in a group. So if you're doing it in a group, you know, I'm the teacher, so I set the container. Confidentiality is really important. There's always some kind of ritual, like I use a gong and a little meditation going in and out of class. So it's like setting a sacred space. And then it's the quality of the listening. And also, you know, it's a really good writing prompt. You know, I go to some sites where they have writing prompts and it's like, you know, you're at an intersection and there's an accident. What do you do? Mm-hmm. there's these things that are, you know, they're not asking questions that really kind of dig inside of you, that really make you think deeply. And so a good writing prompts is part of it. And then I teach writing practice, which was developed by Natalie Goldberg, and she wrote about it in her book, Writing Down the Bones. And, you know, the basic principle is that it's free writing. You write without stopping. You get a prompt, you have a certain amount of time, you write for that amount of time and you write without stopping. You don't cross out, you don't edit, you don't reread, you don't think, oh, damn it, I need a better first sentence, or, you know, it's, what's the name of that tree? You don't do anything editorial. You just let it come out and you let the story meander and go wherever it goes. Mm-hmm. And people access, even in 10 minutes or 15 minutes, can access very, very deep material. Mm-hmm. And I think also in a group setting, what happens is as other people share their work, even the people who are very frightened, begin to get more courageous because they're witnessing other people. And when one thing I love is in a class, when someone breaks open a topic that no one has written about before, it might be sex, it could be money. People never want to write about money and their relationship to it. It could be trauma. Although in my groups, I think because I've written so much about trauma, people know that it's a topic they could write about. Mm-hmm. But when someone breaks open a topic, like a few weeks ago, someone in a class wrote about her son who was a heroin addict, mm-hmm. and she wrote about his addiction. And the next week, three other people in the class wrote about people in their family who were addicted to heroin. And they had been addicted before. They didn't feel they felt too ashamed or traumatized. Mm-hmm. But suddenly someone broke that subject open and it was okay to write about. So I think that's the power of a group. And when you listen to someone else writing in the most intimate way and you feel compassion and love for that person, you start to realize that other people are going to feel that towards you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I was, you're not going to believe this, or maybe you will believe this, but with like 60% of my guests, free writing always comes up. I mean, I first learned it in grad school and I use it now as a tool with my students where let's just write without any judgment or editing for, with kids, I do it for like 5 minutes because that's about how long their attention span can hold. And you never know. I just don't, like, you never know what's going to come out of that. Because I call the free writing like mental vomiting on paper. Just get everything right in your head out. And then you go through and you see if there's something that, there's an idea that you find that perhaps you can develop into an essay or a story or whatever. Or maybe it's just the whole 5 minutes was a cathartic experience for you. But I feel like that's such an amazingly powerful tool to use, especially when you feel like you have no ideas. Just let it all out. So I'm glad that you brought up free writing. I think it's a very important tool.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So now let's talk, because you mentioned about the woman who started writing about her son's heroin addiction, and then that gave others the space to open up and start writing about more difficult things in their lives. How do you write about an experience that you have that might be vague in your memory? Right.
Oh, that's, I love that topic because I teach a whole workshop called How to Write About What You Can't Remember. Mm. And I think that, you know, the first thing is, because I have a terrible memory, so I had to learn some tricks for getting around that. And when I was writing my memoir, there were like huge swaths of time I just didn't remember. And how am I going to tell this story when I don't have good recall? Mm-hmm. So the first thing is that you start with whatever you do remember. So it's almost like let's say, here's an example. There's a scene in my memoir. My mother and I are riding in a car. We've been estranged for many years. This is like one of the first visits. And there's been just such animosity and fighting between us. But here we are in this car. And she started spilling all these secrets about her life to me on that car ride. It was like a 4-hour car ride. Hmm. And when I first went to write that scene, all I remembered really was that we were in a car. It was pouring rain. And she was chain smoking. So I remember she was smoking Parliaments because that's what she smoked, and the car was full of smoke, you know, and there was the cigarette lighter, the kind that had the little red hot center. Yeah. So, you know, and that's what, and then I remembered what some of the stories were. And so I just, but there was so much, I didn't know where we were driving. I don't know when it happened exactly. I don't know where we were going, anything like that. So I just started writing about the things I did know. So I started, I set the scene in the car. I created a very vivid environment. The rain was a huge element in that scene. And so was her smoking. Mm-hmm. And I was able from those things, first of all, as you start to write, you begin to remember more. So it's almost like you start pulling up this thread and then more and more starts coming back to you. So that's one thing is start with the things you do know and see where it takes you. Another technique is to write like a speculative piece. So let's say there's something you can't know, like some secret in your family history, you know, like why did your great uncle and great aunt suddenly split apart and move, one of them moved to California, you know, and everyone's dead or they don't speak to you. So you can't find out. So then you could write something that's more like, I wonder what happened. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was this. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was that. Perhaps this happened. So you're not claiming, you're not creating fiction when you're trying to write memoir, but you're speculating, and it actually can be very powerful to start that way. So like in that car scene, I think I said, you know, I don't know where we were going. Maybe we were going here. Maybe we were going there. And I eventually cut most of that out of the final draft of the piece, but giving myself permission to imagine what might have happened really made a difference. And, you know, the other thing I do sometimes is I'll have people try to identify, you know, what makes writing powerful is writing about a moment, not about like a span of time. So beginners often want to, you know, get the whole story out, like from beginning to end, as if like the plot, they're wanting to reveal the plot of the scene. Right. But really what is significant is what was the pivotal moment in that scene?
Yeah.
What was the moment that is the emotional crux of the interaction between these people? Usually it's interaction between people. And then I would, you know, sometimes guide people, have them do kind of a meditation, a guided meditation where I have them go back to that moment. Mm-hmm. And then I have them think about, okay, imagine where you were. What were you looking at in front of you? What was to the left of you? What was to the right of you? What was under your feet? What was above you? What did you hear in the foreground? What did you hear in the background? What did the air feel like on your skin? And I go through maybe, I don't know, 30 or 40 questions.
Yeah.
And it helps. They start to remember that the viscerally what that moment was like. And then I have them write it down on a piece of paper, a big chart usually. And then when they go to actually write the scene, they have all this vivid detail to pull from. Mm-hmm. And the difference, the vividness of the pieces is dramatically different.
Well,
those are some of the techniques that I teach.
Yeah, I love how you incorporate meditation. I think that's wonderful. Because I remember working with someone who felt she wanted to tell the story of her divorce. And she wanted to write this story down for her daughters because there was like so much animosity between not only her and her ex-husband and then her ex-husband's wife, but also the daughter, in particular one daughter, who was kind of caught in the middle. And she just wanted to, like, in her words, set the record straight. Like, this is my experience, at least, of it. And but there was so much apprehension about just starting to write it. And we would do energy tapping before we would start, and just to help to release some of that tension and the blockages. And it was amazing what the space that put her in, from complete, like, I can't do this, to I'm open to now trying something. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
I think another thing that's really important, and this comes up in almost every class I teach where people are writing memoir, or even if they're writing fiction that's kind of based on some incident in their life, is at the core of it, is that you don't have to publish it, and that you have to create that kind of container. You know, the whole time I was working on the memoir, I had to tell myself I wasn't going to publish it. You know, and my mother had died. It was a mother-daughter story. And after she died, I just said, well, this is part of my grieving process. I need to write this. But I just absolutely was stuck every time I thought about people looking at it. And mostly I was afraid of this small group of family members who I knew would be really horrified by what I was writing, because I'd already been disowned for writing about the same material 30 years earlier. And so I had to just tell myself, I don't have to publish it. I don't have to show this to anyone. And I think that's really important, is to create that kind of safety. That, and you know, sometimes people will they'll put their journal in a locked cupboard, you know, if they feel like they can't trust the people in their environment. I have a box with my old journals, and I've thought about burning them so many times. And yet, I don't know, there's part of me that doesn't want to let go of them. So they're in this big kind of plastic tub in a storage, and there's a big sign on the top for my children who are adults saying, burn this if I die. I really don't want them reading about, you know, my coke binges of my 20s and my doubts about my marriage and what it was like. You know, I really don't. People do things like that, or they might, like, if you're their writing coach, they would write it and send it to you, and you would hold it for them. And they wouldn't have it on their computer at all. So I think people need to figure out what they need to feel safe.
Yeah.
And even if you set up all those conditions, it's terrifying. It can be terrifying and liberating to tell the truth. I mean, Muriel Rukeyser said, what would happen if one woman told the truth about her life? The world would split open.
I mean, Laura, that brings me, so let's talk about the ethics of writing about family, because that's a tough one. How do you, when you're writing your story, your truth, and it involves family members or loved ones, are there boundaries that are should not be crossed?
Yes, I think so. And I don't think there's one answer. You know, it depends on what you're writing. I mean, I think you could write anything. The question is, are you going to publish it? Because I think we should give ourselves absolute license to write anything. That's I think that's critical. But the question is, am I going to then do something with it where other people are going to get to read it? And I've shifted on this in the course of my 35 years as a writer, more than 35 years. At first, my attitude when I was young, you know, when I was in my 20s at writing, my attitude was, because I was writing about trauma. I was writing about the sexual abuse in my family. And my attitude was, this happened. I'm telling the truth. You're in denial. Screw you. You know, like, I have a right to tell the truth, and that I'm breaking silence. And, you know, I felt very, I had a lot of, I gave myself license to do whatever I wanted, because I had truth on my side. Mm-hmm. And I don't regret anything I published during that time. My most famous book, The Courage to Heal, came out of that. And I don't regret publishing that book at all, even though it led to years of estrangement from my mother's side of the family. But I feel differently now because I'm older. I worked to reconcile those relationships over more than 20 years. It took 20 years. And so when I was thinking about this memoir and whether to publish it, it was a huge decision because of how people would react. And also, it was really essential to me. This is, since I said it's a mother-daughter story, I did not want to present my mother as a villain. Mm-hmm. And when I had beta readers, you know, who are like early readers reading different drafts, the one question I kept asking in every round was, how does the mother character come across? Mm-hmm. Because, when it, at the end, at first, I think I was making myself the hero and mm-hmm. she was the villain. Mm-hmm. And I was not really revealing my underbelly and my, you know, all the things where I was a terrible daughter. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, I was the good one and she was the, you know, but I kept writing and writing and writing. And by the time I got to the end, people would say, I loved your mother. She was such a complex character. Mm-hmm. And there's no black and white characters in this story. And that was really, really important to me. Mm-hmm. So I think one thing is, don't write a vindictive, I tell my students, I have no interest in a revenge book.
Right.
You know, someone who's writing something because they're getting back at someone or they want to prove someone else wrong. I feel like that's fine in a journal.
Yeah.
But it's not literature. And I don't think I don't encourage that. I mean, it may be a step in the process. But I think what I love to see is a book where every character is three-dimensional. Mm-hmm. And you get not just the truth of who they were, but compassion for who they were. Mm-hmm. And a deeper understanding of the forces that shape people to making terrible mistakes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with this book, there's the main characters, my mother, I waited till she died to publish it. And then her generation died out. I mean, she was, 86. So there were two surviving octogenarians in my family. Mm-hmm. I waited until they died. I didn't have to, but I just felt like I wanted to. Mm-hmm. But if I wait for my cousins to die, I would never publish this book.
Right.
And then, you know, my spouse, my wife is a character. My three children are characters. My granddaughter is a character. My brother is a character. And I went to all of them and got their permission to write about them. Mm. And they all read the manuscript. They gave me great feedback, great notes. And they were okay with it. My spouse, it was the hardest on her because she's an incredibly private person. And she's married to an incredibly public person who writes very intimate things about personal things. So what I ended up having to do in her case was I minimized her role. So even though she was hugely significant in this story, I didn't really reveal anything about her. And when people read the book, they will say, you know, God, you and your mother are so powerful as characters. And, you know, Karen, she's just kind of like, she's like the perfect spouse. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I couldn't really give a full accounting of who she was. And I also didn't reveal anything intimate about her. Mm-hmm. You know, so she's basically a supportive spouse. And mm-hmm. so it's not fully accurate. But I felt like the weight of the major characters carried it along. And my brother was willing to be written about. And so I focused more on him. I brought him much more into the story, sort of as a foil for me. And he was very good-natured about allowing me to do it. But he looked at the book and there were some things he at one point he said, I want you to say more good things about me. And it's true. I had kind of painted him as a fool in many ways. So I did. I went back and I consciously layered in more of his positive qualities, which are true. Mm-hmm. And he ultimately approved of it.
Mm-hmm. So, but because you, Where is the line then between when you're writing a memoir, fiction and nonfiction?
Can you, I'm not exactly sure what you're trying to ask.
So, yeah, if you're writing, because you mentioned that when you, I forget what character you were talking about. I think the character of your either brother or your wife, where you had to reduce their role. So if you are, in other words, I guess my question is, does memoir have to be totally true? Or can you add elements of fiction in there, things that actually did not happen?
You can't add things that did not happen. But what you can do is you could emphasize certain things and de-emphasize other things. So it's like, what's in the foreground and what's in the background? Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you're writing memoir, there's your life is so full. And it's largely, what are you going to leave out? So I chose to create a storyline that emphasized certain events that happened. They happened. Mm-hmm. And I didn't include other things that also happened that would have revealed things I didn't want to reveal. It could be things about myself, or it could be things about the people I was writing about. So it's always like what's in the foreground. And there were a lot of different ways I could have told this story. But you can't just invent things, mm-hmm. you know, unless you're doing what I said before, which is like, I wonder if this, what if this had happened, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm.
But that would not be public. That's fiction. Like, what if this, the speculative writing.
No, it's part of a memoir because I'm not claiming something happened. I'm wondering. I'm not, fiction would be claiming that something was true that never happened. And that's where memoir writers get into trouble, you know, is they make stuff up and they make it up and then claim it is what actually happened. Yeah. And, you know, memoir is not a literal recounting of events. Like maybe an autobiography is much more of a linear story of a life, but memoir is how we remember our life. Mm-hmm. And it's our memory of it. And, you know, anyone who has a sibling knows that multiple people could go through the same experience and remember it completely differently, mm-hmm. depending on birth order, personality, how they were treated, all kinds of things, you know, whether they were in the room or not. So it's how I remember my life. And it's the other thing about memoir that I enjoy is it's the meaning of my life. It's like now I'm looking back and what perspective do I have on those events that I didn't have at the time. So it's both the story of the person as it happened, creating those scenes in real time in a vivid way, but it's also the writer looking back and adding that, I call it like the wisdom voice. You know, it's the wisdom voice going back and saying, you know, if I knew this now, maybe this wouldn't have happened. So there's room for speculation and there's room for musing, which is the writer, you know, basically getting takeaways on their own life.
Yeah.
There's a quote, you know, an epigraph that I put in the front of the book that I really love. It was from a former student of mine, Deborah Fouché. And she said, every time I look in the rearview mirror, the past has changed. Hmm. And that's right in the front of my book because, you know, if I had written this memoir 20 years ago, I would have written it totally differently. And if I was writing it 10 years from now, I would be telling a different story. Mm-hmm. Not because I'm not telling the truth, but because the things I would choose to focus on and the interpretation of those events. I mean, it took me so many years to write this because I didn't have the maturity or the emotional or spiritual strength to really tell more of the truth. I mean, we have these superficial stories we tell. I mean, I call them like habitual stories. Mm-hmm. And the habitual story is like, this is what happened. And then we retell it over and over and over again. And it's like these grooves get stronger and stronger until it becomes the truth.
Right.
When it's really just a story we told about an event that happened. And I'm always encouraging my students to get to the story under the story. And I'll often say, what's the part you never told anyone before? Mm-hmm. And that's a very powerful prompt, mm-hmm. Because you're giving yourself permission to get below your storyline. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what haven't I told about this event?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I find that with a lot of memoir writing, and I think you kind of touched on this earlier. You want to really focus on solely your experience, which, I mean, it mostly is about your experience, but without really having empathy for the person that you perceive as being the bad guy in your story. And it's just all about you being the victim, and this is what happened. And there's not enough introspection. Like, what did I learn from this experience? How did I grow? And how am I a different person at the end than I was at the beginning? Was that a process for you where you had to really dig deep and look at, okay, how am I different in the end than I was in the beginning of the story? What have I learned? How have I grown?
I think that's what people, you know, I think most people, especially reading memoir, they want to see the character, the protagonist, evolve. They want to see them grow. And I mean, sometimes it's a tragic story and sometimes it's a more optimistic story. But I think, that's the arc of your story. It's not, and the arc of the story is not this happened and then this happened and then this happened and this whole episodic, that's not very interesting to read. What's interesting to read is conflict. And what's interesting to read is watching a character struggle to be a better person, or to, in my book is about, could I open my heart to my mother when she had betrayed me, and when I had learned to cope by basically having a closed heart and under a lot of pressure, you know, the circumstances created a pressure cooker. And was I going to be able to show up and become the daughter she needed me to be at the end of her life when we had a history of betrayal? So that's the question I had to answer in my life. And it's also the question I explore in the memoir.
When you finished the book, did you have more love or empathy for your mother? Did your relationship change with your mother when you finished the book?
I don't know about when I finished it, but absolutely the process of writing it had me going way deeper into our relationship. And this was after she died. I mean, I was working on it when she was still alive. I was, you know, it took me over 10 years to write this. But yes, it definitely changed my relationship. And, you know, there's actually a way, I would say it's negative. I haven't really articulated this, but, and I have talked to other memoir writers about this. The thing I think that's dangerous about writing memoir is that when you write it, you craft a story. So something happened and you write it to be a good story, which means, again, you emphasize certain details, you de-emphasize other details. It's all true. But then that becomes, it's like almost like what you write supplants your original memories. So that, like, these stories that were intimate stories, in a way, I'm giving them away to the world. So I'm losing some kind of private, intimate story by crafting it into a story that other people are going to read and interpret. And when I go back and try to remember it, what I'm probably going to remember is what I wrote, not anything I'm directly accessing. Mm-hmm. So I think that's like an occupational hazard of writing memoir that is not talked about very much.
But you know what's interesting, Laura, is perhaps all of like the original story before, you know, you crafted the story can be found in journals that you wrote. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's there.
Some of it, but I wasn't that. Some people who are like super consistent journal keepers, yes, but that's not me. So, and most of the events I write about in this book are not in any journal because I wasn't keeping journals then. But, it's okay. I mean, it's a trade-off, I guess, because I feel like I was able to find the universal. I mean, I think that's the other thing when you're writing memoir. To me, the memoirs I love and the ones that really have staying power go beyond just the personal story. They touch on some universal chords, some universal questions that we have about life or about relationships. And even the other ones I love are ones that actually tell a broader story. So maybe it's about a historical period of time and there's a lot about the history, or it's about a place and it's a lot about that place, or it's about a profession, you know, and then I learn all about being a lobster woman. So I think when it becomes too narrow, it's just you and your story. You know, that's the difference between being a writer and an author. And there's a big difference. You know, when you're writing for yourself, anything goes. But when you're writing to entertain and to educate or to inspire, and you want to have an audience, you have to write it in a way that's not just this is what happened, but this is what's universal about my story, and that's what I'm going to focus on.
Mm.
So that someone else reading it, you know, mine is a story of estrangement and reconciliation. And I've had, you know, some of my beta readers said things like, you know, after I read your book, I picked up the phone and called my mother for the first time in 18 years,
mm-hmm.
or I've never thought so deeply about my mother. So, I mean, that's like music to my ears, that I want people to have a powerful experience about their own life,
mm-hmm.
not just that was a good story, mm-hmm. you know, or, you know, that was really interesting, or so that was my goal anyway. And I think that sometimes that you start with the very, very personal, and as you rewrite and write new drafts and new versions, these other things get layered in. And the story becomes much more complex than just this is what happened to me.
Mm-hmm. I was talking to before I start talking to you earlier, a young filmmaker, and he was talking about characters and how when he's writing a story, he always keeps in mind the audience, and the audience, they want to see themselves on the screen, right? He does that through showing empathy, even for like the characters that we see are mean or ugly or whatever. He'll, you know, have the scene where the mean guy is helping an old lady across the street.
That's right, exactly.
He's like, oh, wait a minute. I'm supposed to not like this guy, but here he is doing something. And I think that's just, it's so powerful when you can do that in your own narrative, because then you actually begin, like with you and your mother, you begin to see these characters in your lives through another lens, and you begin to be more empathetic, and your relationships, it can really shift relationships, especially if they're still living, because now you just have a new perspective on what they went through or they experienced or who they are.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that sometimes even when one person in a relationship changes, like you're talking about, mm-hmm. it can influence the other person. It's almost like it reverberates through the generation. Yeah. It reverberates down to your children or your grandchildren, or reverberates back to your ancestors. I mean, that's what I believe.
Yeah.
So I think the work we do on ourselves has mm-hmm. huge repercussions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Laura, oh gosh, I feel like I could just keep talking about this because it's just it's a powerful, powerful topic. But for, you know what I want to ask you is what's your favorite memoir? Not that you've written, but like from someone else.
I don't know that I have one favorite, you know. I mean, I love The Glass Castle.
Yes.
Classic memoir. I mean, I like a lot of the classic ones. Yeah. I loved Wild.
Mm-hmm.
There's just so many. And I think the ones that I love the most, they bring in the bigger world.
Yeah.
And also that they have... There's one that I really loved called Half the House by Richard Hoffman. It's an older book. Huh. And what I loved about that is he was someone who was sexually abused by a coach.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like a lived in this white working class family. And his father was a really angry drinker and just, you know, really a difficult father. And the kid escaped by doing sports, and he was really good at it. And he was sexually abused by this coach. And it ends up that coach had sexually abused, I think, 400 boys. And he describes his father, who was really a bastard, in such human terms. And then he describes his father going off to the Korean War and coming back and how he was changed. And so you have this feeling of like, this father went through this trauma, and then he had two severely disabled children, plus this boy, and instead of him being a villain, he's so human.
Mm.
And I just love that. So yeah. So I like books that really have that complexity of the characters.
Mm-hmm. Laura, tell us where we can find you.
You can find me information about all my classes and workshops and retreats at lauradavis.net. And if you would like to read the first five chapters of the memoir, The Burning Light of Two Stars, you can just go to lauradavis.net/chapters. And you could read the it's quite five chapters is quite a bit actually, and then decide if it's a book that you want to finish. Mm-hmm. On Facebook, I'm at The Writer's Journey. But if you just go to my website, lauradavis.net, that's the best way to link up with me, and lauradavis.net/chapters to read the opening of the book.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any final words of wisdom or advice for someone who is considering writing their story, but they're feeling a bit apprehensive?
Just do it for yourself, and you'll feel better. I mean, sometimes you don't feel better right away. Yeah. Sometimes it's painful, but once you uncork all the things that are buried inside of you that you're not letting out, you'll feel better. There's a freedom in getting it out on the page. Just do it safely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's wonderful advice. Thank you so much, Laura. This has been wonderful.
It's been great to talk to you.
After having had that conversation with Laura, I felt as though I had just finished sitting in a writing class. She has some wonderful insights and tips to share about how to write your personal stories, because that can be a very scary and painful process. And I appreciate how she uses writing as that tool for healing the pain and the trauma and sifting through all the different memories and then the emotions attached to those memories to draw out and organize into a narrative. I think it's a very powerful process. And if you are interested in learning more about Laura and her books, please visit, because I think that you will not be disappointed. In the meantime, also visit zazel.com and sign up for my newsletter. You can follow me on social media. I'm on Twitter at Ebony Haywood, and I'm on Instagram and Facebook at Motivation to Write. And if you were inspired by this episode, then please share the episode with a friend or with someone who you feel will benefit from Laura's message. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I will see you next time when I talk to another fabulous guest. Bye-bye.